You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 3rd, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. You're broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, we've got protests, we've got police violence, and we had primaries. Aaron Kleinman, Director of Research of Future Now, will join us about the COVID primaries. Meanwhile, protests last night largely calm in the wake of days of police rioting. In Indiana, racist lunatic Steve King loses his primary to another lunatic who more quietly supports racist policies. Meanwhile, Bill Barr turns out to be the one responsible for ordering, I guess, the violence against peaceful protests at the White House Monday. Speaking of which, Republican lawmakers defend Trump's violent church photo op, but does spur a Defense Department resignation and a lot of like, whoa, I didn't realize. Last night, cops held thousands on a Manhattan bridge as over 100 folks spent more than 24 hours in jail waiting on a hearing for protesting. State of Minnesota files a civil rights charges against the Minneapolis Police Department. Meanwhile, a Minnesota school board, or I should say Minneapolis school board, cancels their contract with the MPD. And the last person ever to receive a Civil War pension has died. Sadly, can't say the same for a lot of the themes that ran through that Civil War. And finally, a hearing on Capitol Hill. But oops, it's Ron Rosenstein testifying on Obamagate. The FBI found no intel indicating Antifa involvement in the Washington, D.C. protests. Shocking. And Joe Biden to attend George Floyd's funeral. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. I hope folks are doing well, managing both physically and emotionally through this, ongoing just parade of horrors and sadness and depression. And but you know, in some cases, there's some silver linings, without a doubt. Some nascent initiatives to curb the power of police, still, of course, very nascent, but in municipalities around the country, and also, you know, and maybe we'll talk to Aaron about this a little bit. I don't know if he has any data on this. He's a data guy, but certainly, one of the things that one would have anticipated on paper, maybe, or at least would have contemplated, would be how do Democrats, establishment, normie Democrats, elected leaders, how do they react to the gambit by Donald Trump to attempt to stir his base and to win this election, because that's what it's all about for him, by projecting himself as a strong law and order guy And this warrants more conversation. Did I say Indiana? I meant Iowa with Steve King. Sorry. This warrants more conversation, but for many, 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 many years, certainly through my lifetime, the specter of 1968 and 1972 elections have haunted the Democratic Party. Back when I started doing this, the era of the ascendance of the blogs, there was this term about hippie punching. And we don't hear it that much because people don't, I don't know if a lot of people who are involved in politics today don't really have a real sense of hippies are just not something that you hear people talk about anymore. But that was because there was a huge fear that if the Democrats in any way were perceived as not for social order, if they were perceived weak on civil unrest and crime in some respects, and if they were just considered soft on law and order because they were associated with the hippies. And certainly, you know, things like Joe Biden grandstanding about the 93 crime bill and just the entire 93 crime bill is a good example of that. Even Sanders, you know, was sort of protecting that flank at that time to some degree. And today, the reaction from top Democratic leaders is not, you know, necessarily where I would want it to be, but it is not, they're not cowering at the idea of being associated in any way with the protesters. And the irony is that while this, that mentality of that era has dominated the left in many respects, the broadly speaking, the left, the Democratic Party. It's interesting that they are trying to run that same playbook. They're trying to run Richard Nixon's playbook from 1968. And they're doing so without any, you know, the problem in the past is that the Democrats have run that playbook and or reacted to it in a, without any sense of the context in which they were operating. And I think the Republicans are now doing the same thing and making the same mistake, because the difference between 1968 and now are quite large. Not the least of which is that white people are marginally better than they were in 1968 in terms of issues of race, or that there's enough white people who are better, marginally better on the issues of race. We have cell phones. You know, we have like, you know, there's whether people were in denial or were just simply ignorant, you don't have that same luxury to have to be in denial or ignorant, because it's so obvious today with the advent of phones and video cameras. Also, I would add, Richard Nixon was not in charge at that time, so he could not do anything to screw it up like Donald Trump has by exerting way too much violence and force. And so people should be encouraged by that on some level. We'll talk more about it. But let's look at this. So Donald Trump on, and the story's coming out. And look, you know, this is you read these stories, these TikToks of how decisions are made in the White House. And in all honesty, I don't know that they're terribly useful. You know, the New York Times has like a how this decision was made, et cetera, et cetera. And it was Ivanka's idea for him to go to the church, and who knows, right? I mean, the people who leak this stuff to Maggie Haberman and all the other, reporters on the Times, they all have their agendas. But what appears to be the case is that it was Bill Barr. They had this plan to go and clear out the area, and it hadn't been done. Bill Barr went out to inspect and looked around and says, it hadn't been done. So we got to get this done. And they had brought in basically like a whole mishmash of agencies, police agencies, federal police agencies, and seemed to have like re-deputized them as like general DOJ thugs. I mean, it's really, someday somebody's going to write about this and find how horrific it was. But, and then he had them clear it out for Donald Trump to go take this walk. It is, there was, by the accounts of mainstream journalists, not 2%, not 98% peaceful, not 99% peaceful, 100% peaceful. And we got clips, I've seen clips from Australian journalists, American journalists. They're all just literally shocked at the way that these federal police, unnamed agencies, federal police, attacked protesters, attacked them, violently attacked them, including the use of a military helicopter, a medic helicopter. It was a Lakota medevac helicopter, unarmed. Let's play the clip of the Lakota unarmed helicopter hovering over over demonstrators. And then we'll play the clip of the response of Republican senators. Now, just for your information, here's the helicopter. This was later in the evening. That's a photo. We don't have any video. Do it. Now, this is being used to intimidate the protesters. You see that the thing gets quite violent at that point. There's no experts who have looked at that and said it was being used to do anything other than intimidate protesters. You're not supposed to fly a helicopter that low to the ground. It's extremely dangerous. On top of which, because it had a Red Cross, the sort of medic symbol, it is a breach of Geneva Conventions to use a vehicle like that for that type of purpose. Somebody had died. You're in like war crimes territory under the Geneva Conventions. But that wasn't nearly as disturbing as the footage that we watched yesterday of the riot gear, the military police attacking protesters. Here is the Republican Party in basically, you know, like one of these walk of shames that they do, the senators going into a lunch, all of them pretending like they had no idea. I haven't been able to watch any TV. I had no idea of the massive protests, the most violent removal of protesters from Washington, anywhere in Washington, D.C., in probably generations. Here is their responses. This is like a parade of cowards.
The president did last night the right thing to do. What the president did, the peaceful protesters that were dispersed with tear gas, he then walked across the street to the church. Was that the right thing to do?
Didn't really see it.
Was what the president did last night right? Was what the president did and what unfolded at the White House last night appropriate? Senator Roberts, was what the president did last night at St. John's, was that appropriate? Was clearing the protesters an abuse of power? I'm sorry?
I don't know how to call that.
I wasn't there, so I didn't see exactly what happened. But I mean, I think that he was just trying to make a point. And it's hard in a polarized environment like this. So
you don't have any comment on what happened at the White House last night?
The what?
The gassing of White House protesters. Do they have a right?
Yeah, I didn't watch that. I'm close enough to know what
happened.
Senator Enzi,
Mitt Romney.
Are you concerned at all about what happened at the White House last night?
I did not think that we saw last night was going to be a very good
idea. Senator Portman, do you think what we saw last night at the White House, was it an abuse of power, what we saw last night outside the White House?
By the protesters, yes. By the violence, yes.
You know, I've heard conflicting things about, well, the president, the Park Service, the Secret Service didn't know that the president was going to come through. So I don't know what the actual facts are. I think those would be useful things to find out.
Yeah, I mean, that's every single one of them a coward. Lisa Murkowski being the sort of the beacon of courage in the Republican caucus by saying that's not the America I know.
Malik, Josh Hawley's strategy of waiting for more useful facts is the GOP strategy.
We need to investigate this. I need to know the facts on just exactly, you know, what was the process by which these cops came in with their shields and banged across reporters and off the heads of innocent and peaceful protesters. And, you know, like, I just want to know, like, what was the projectiles they were sending? I just want to know what the thickness on the rubber was. Well, I think we need to know these questions about whether they were, you know, 2 millimeters or 3 millimeters thick before I respond to them. These are all facts that we really need to know.
AG in Missouri. So,
yeah.
I'm familiar with this.
I also like the fact that that guy felt that the violence was an abuse of power, but not the president's order for the violence. All the violence, 100% of it came from these military police, these federales, I guess. Really despicable. And, you know, I don't know how long it's going to take. I don't know what it's going to take until top Democrats start holding those guys to account. The enablers are worse than Trump at this point. Frankly, I've always thought that they are worse, period. They should be held to account. But, well, I don't want to do anything that's going to ruin our, you know, Senate committee. Before we get to Aaron, obviously difficult times. There is, however, some upsides. Pet adoption apparently is up. Shelters are being cleared out. And that means a lot of people have a new dog and they don't know much about that dog. Well, Embark's breed and health test is the best way to help you know your new doggy. And frankly, your old doggy, if you don't know. Gives you breed traits, gives you genetic risk factors, which are hugely important for health conditions, obviously. They provide the resources, Embark does, for you and your vet to best tailor diet and just general care for your dog's specific needs. Embark can identify over 350 breeds. They can identify and screen for 175 genetic health conditions. Over 50% of the dogs are either at risk or carriers for genetic disease. Embark will help you learn their health history. It's developed by PhDs, Embark was, and vets, and is the number one trusted source for breed detection and accuracy. I don't have a dog. I do know that, you know, cats are my kids consider them their brothers, actually. And so any insight into their health, huge benefit. Kelly had this to say about doing the Embark test on her dog Edie. She said there's so much information about her. She tested clear for all 175 genetic health conditions they screened for. She's not a carrier or at risk for any of the genetic diseases they have as well. There's also a full clinical trait report. So much great news, but most importantly, I can provide the report to her vet, which will provide so much information to help with Edie's health as she grows up. We've gotten, you know, emails about finding out stuff about their dog, a dog that's hugely important to their kids, or folks who just enjoy finding out who their dog's cousins are. This summer, Embark has a limited time offer just for our listeners. You go to embarkvet.com now. Use the promo code MAJORITY. You get $50 off your dog, breed, and health kit. That's embarkvet.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY. You get $50 off today. Super easy to swab your dog. Get to it. You're going to enjoy it. And again, we will put that link in our YouTube description and on our podcast description. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Aaron Kleinman. Peter on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome back to the program the Director of Research at Future Now. Director of Research and Director of Campaigns, I think, too. Future Now, Aaron Kleinman. Oh, wait, I'm confused now, Aaron. Are you still Bobby Big Wheel on Twitter? Because now it says, like, are you Dr. Munchausen or something?
No, it's an old Simpsons reference, Maynard G. Muskie vote. That's what Mr. Burns calls Democrats.
Ah, okay. Well, I just don't like to watch animation. I know it's a funny show, and I know I should have, and it was certainly in my heyday, but I didn't watch it because I don't like animation.
I won't tell Lizzie Molina that you don't like watching animation.
Please, and don't tell the folks on Bob's Burgers too. Please, that would be a problem. But all right. With all that said, it's sort of hard to conceive and to remember. But we had a lot of primaries around the country yesterday. Let's get into those, and then I want to talk about this report that you guys put out about Wisconsin. That's fascinating information. I think it's going to be really important, or could very well be, in the fall. But before we get there, we had, as far as I can tell, primaries in Maryland, in Indiana. We had primaries in Iowa. We had primaries in New Mexico and Pennsylvania. I guess Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. Where else? Am I missing any?
Rhode Island and I think South Dakota, too.
Rhode Island and South Dakota. So give me a sense of what are the ones that are relevant to us? What are the ones that were surprising? And where did progressives do well?
Yeah. So I think if you look at the results from last night, one thing really jumps out at you, and it's that there is an anti-incumbent mood right now. It appears especially in Pennsylvania and New Mexico, where we saw a number of incumbents lose their primaries to challengers. Now, in state legislative races, 98% of incumbents, give or take, win renomination. So it's pretty significant to see large numbers, especially in these two states, go down. And so,
and that's both both Democrat and Republican?
Mostly on the Democratic side, but we did see a few Republicans lose primaries as well. And, you know, I would say it seems like the mood on the streets seems to be manifesting itself in the ballot box as well, where people are dissatisfied with the status quo.
And when we see those changes, now you're talking, are you talking like in terms of Congress? You're talking mostly in terms of state seats.
In state legislatures is where we saw the huge numbers. I think in Congress, obviously, the big story was Steve King in Iowa losing a renomination on the Republican line. I think if you look at Republican primaries, he might be the first incumbent or congressional incumbent to lose a Republican primary because he's too conservative since 2002.
Right.
Which shows you kind of how that party has drifted.
All right,
ideologically.
I want to circle back to that because I think that that's I'm not sure about that characterization, but you're the data guy, so you would probably know better. But let's stay with the state races for a second. In these instances where we saw the incumbent lose, and I'm happy to hear that because I think we can always do better, frankly. But for the most part, did we do better? In other words, from a progressive perspective, were the state representatives and senators who were defeated in a primary, at least on the Democratic side, were they replaced with people who are more progressive?
In Pennsylvania and New Mexico, yes. For the most part, I would say. There were some challenges that didn't have an ideological angle to them, especially when you deal with state legislative races. There can be very local and picayune concerns that can really drive a primary. But if you look at New Mexico, there were 7 moderate to conservative Democrats in New Mexico that progressive groups targeted. And like I said, 98% or so of state legislators tend to win renomination. It looks like, and again, one thing to keep in mind with all these results is that a lot of mail-in ballots still haven't come in yet. So we don't have final results. And, but in New Mexico, it looks like between 3 and 5 of those 7 have lost renomination.
Go ahead. Yeah. No, go ahead.
And then in Pennsylvania, and again, that issue with mail-in ballots, if you're looking ahead to November, on election night in Pennsylvania, November, you're going to probably see Trump go out to a big lead because all the small counties that he wins big have been able to count all their absentee ballots, while the bigger counties around Philadelphia are taking longer. So again, in Pennsylvania, keep that in mind. There's still a lot of ballots left to be counted, but we saw a number of races where the incumbents lost to challenges from the left, concentrated in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, but even one in the Lehigh Valley. Again, there's the incumbent currently, I think, has a slim lead on a challenger with a lot of absentee ballots outstanding. And these do tend to be left-wing challenges, though there are some non-ideological components to these.
Do we have one where, you know, I don't know, it was, I mean, I get the idea that there's, you know, we have, at that level, there's some that are non-ideological, but were there anywhere somebody was considered too left? Like, you know, we had some DSA people who were up for re-election, right, in yeah. Pennsylvania, and how did they do?
So, yeah, actually, Summer Lee was the most prominent. She's actually an incumbent who won in 2018 her primary as a member of the DSA. She faced a challenge from the right in her primary. And like I said, there are ballots outstanding, but she won by so much that it's really hard to see how any remaining ballots would change the outcome for her. She won big.
That's consistent with what we've seen with, across the board. In other words, we have examples of progressives defeating more conservative incumbents, but we don't have really the opposite, do we?
Yeah, I haven't seen too many examples of someone losing a primary because they were too liberal. And, you know, I would say sometimes a more liberal candidate incumbent will lose a primary to a more moderate candidate. It tends to be a non-ideological thing with that liberal candidate and that the moderate candidate seizes on. It doesn't seem very common that a Democrat wins an ideological primary against an incumbent running to the center.
Where are we on like some of these sort of higher profile races like Steny Hoyer's? Do we know? We're basically just, we don't have any results. We don't have that many results yet, do we?
Well, in Maryland, we do have, I mean, Steny Hoyer's up big.
Right.
I don't see how they claw that back. I mean, you know, he's a member, when you're a member of leadership in the House, it is a really hard challenge. I think Michaela Wilkes, she ran into really the headwinds of COVID. Like, you know, a lot of these challengers, especially in congressional races, you know, a big part of it, you know, what AOC used to beat Joe Crowley, and what Ayanna Pressley used to beat Mike Capuano was really a grassroots door knocking centered campaign that you just can't do in COVID. But in these, you know, in state legislative races, on the other hand, you know, it's a lot easier to make a difference. It's a lot easier to access the grassroots. Like in Philadelphia, Nikhil Saval, who is ahead big on incumbent Larry Farnese, he had a very extensive digital and mail program that was aimed at, you know, it's a smaller segment of voters. And so it's a lot easier for something like that to catch on than, you know, Michaela Wilkes. She just had a much bigger district with out the ability to really run the grassroots campaign she wanted. So it's just, you know, it's very difficult to knock off an incumbent in a pandemic conditions.
That's going to be a big dynamic, right? I mean, I feel like we had, as far as I can tell, the biggest, the deepest and biggest pool of progressive challengers to sitting incumbent Congress people, and I would imagine, state Senate, on the state level as well, although I don't know that, and you'd know that better, that I feel like I've ever seen in my lifetime. I mean, is that just in terms of sheer numbers and quality of candidates? Is that the case? And if so, COVID is going to play a big role in keeping those sort of upset races down, the number of those upset victories down.
Yeah, I would say there's been an obvious trend toward more of them. And I think the thing to keep in mind with these is that it's not a one electoral cycle fight. I mean, you look at Illinois, for example, Marie Newman barely falls short in 2018, comes back in 2020 and wins the primary. And I think especially going into 2022, that is a redistricting cycle. And that means that all these incumbents, every single one in the country, is going to have at least some new turf that they have to run on that they're not familiar with. And so, you see people, you know, if you see someone fall short that you wanted to win this year, you really shouldn't despair, because, 2022 is going to, you know, you can see that these challenges tend to gain momentum over time, and that 2022, every incumbent's going to have new turf to defend. So I think you will see a lot more primary challenges. It'll continue to grow, and that I think they'll can be even more successful in 2022.
Are there any other that we should mention? I was, I don't know. Was I right to be surprised? I mean, I got to be honest with you. I don't follow New Mexico politics too much. But I just assumed, because Valerie Plame had a sort of bigger national profile, that she would win that race. But as far as I can tell, she did not. And that the Teresa Leger Fernandez, who beat her, is to her left.
Yeah, you know, that in that primary, I think it's hard to say. You know, I think there was a significant ideological overlap between the two, but, you know, Teresa Leger Fernandez had been in that district. She had specifically worked at organizing in Native communities. And it's a, you know, that district is very, it's a sprawling rural area, very diverse. And, you know, if you have that experience organizing in disparate parts of it, the way that she does, it really gives you a leg up. And so Plame hadn't lived there for nearly as long, hadn't been involved for nearly as long. And so, you know, money certainly helps you win elections, name recognition, certainly helps you win elections. But if you have a presence in that community, if you have a record of helping out that community, that's also something that you can run on. And, you know, Plame didn't have those things and Leger Fernandez did.
All right. So let's talk about that explicit racist idiot Steve King in Iowa. He loses to, what is his guy's name?
Randy Feenstra.
And now you characterize it as it's the first time that somebody to the right within a Republican primary has lost, you know, in a long time, or at least the most high, high profile. But we should also remind people, right? This guy Feenstra, he thinks COVID is a hoax, that it's, you know, it's, you know, his rhetoric is pretty xenophobic towards the Chinese. He was sort of running on the fact that it seems to me that King was no longer effective because he was incompetently racist, as opposed to just being racist, and therefore could no longer sit on committees and therefore was not sufficiently supportive of Trump, or at least effectively supportive of Trump. Is that a fair characterization? I mean, what am I missing here? That, you know, like, I mean, I guess you could say like being more explicitly racist as opposed to just like supporting racist policies, or a racist in the presidency is, you know, I guess marginally to the left of Steve King, but,
Yeah. I think that's fair. You know, I didn't say that he was, you know, George Romney or Nelson Rockefeller, but he is marginally to the left of Steve King. You know, if you look at that race, it really, you know, it wasn't explicitly about King being too conservative, but it's kind of hard to, you know, I'm not a big fan of ignoring the subtext. And the subtext of this race was Steve King is so far on the conservative fringe that he's an ineffective congressman. And that, and I mean, I will say it is notable that King, you know, had been stripped of his committee slots. He really wasn't able to raise a lot of money, had very little establishment support, had this record of really, you know, being, again, at the very fringe of the right wing, still came within 10% of winning.
Right.
And so, you know, it's I think as a net, it's, you know, for anyone, it's good that he's gone. I mean, there's one less voice introducing the very fringe of the right wing, the Chuck Johnsons of the world, into the halls of Congress. And that, I think that that's still a net good, even if Randy Feenstra will vote the same way. But yeah, it shows you that, you know, it hasn't been cured. They haven't cured themselves of the, you know, of the milieu that gives rise to someone like King.
Yeah, they won't. I don't think they're going to cure themselves of that for a long, long time. But is this one of those things where careful what you wish for? Because now, I mean, was there a chance that that guy J.K. Shulton, is that his name, Shulton?
J.D. Shulton.
J.D. Yeah. Shulton could have won against King, less of a chance against Feenstra.
Yeah, you know, Shulton came within 5% in 2018 in a presidential year. It's possible. I mean, it seems very unlikely that he would win just because Democrats don't need that seat. So they probably won't spend a ton of resources trying to win it. And especially after the next round of redistricting in Iowa, it seems likely that seat will probably get more conservative. And so it just doesn't seem like Shulton, because he's run against King, because he's, you know, he has a big profile, he'll still be able to raise money. But I think he'll, you know, the seat was on the board, but it was never really something that Democrats needed. So the net benefit of having Steve King out of Congress, I think, outweighs, you know, whatever marginal benefit there was to having J.D. Shulton potentially keep that seat for one term.
Okay, fair enough. Let's just look ahead to next Tuesday, and then we'll talk about Wisconsin. What do you got about next Tuesday? Next Tuesday is another big primary day, but, you know, I imagine it's going to have the same sort of like it's going to land with a big splat, and we're not going to really know the results for some time in certain instances, right?
Yeah. All the states are still trying to figure out, especially states that have mail-in balloting is a relatively new phenomenon, or at least large mail-in balloting is a relatively new phenomenon. They're taking a while, and you're seeing that in Pennsylvania. This was their first cycle with no excuse absentee balloting, and so you're seeing there it's disparate between counties on just like how quickly they can count these, and the smaller ones are just having a far easier go of it than the larger ones. And like states like Oregon and Colorado and California that have had extensive mail-in balloting in the past and are held up as paragons, they didn't go from 0 to 60 right away. It was a process that they developed the ability, the institutional know-how to count mail-in ballots over time. And even in California, it takes them weeks to count every ballot. I think it's actually a relatively new phenomena where Americans expect election results to on election night. In the past, if you go to the very beginning of the country, that just technologically wasn't possible. And I think
that was 250 years ago.
Yeah, but I mean, even in the going back to the earlier in the 20th century, you just didn't get election results that quickly. It took a while to compile everything.
Well, let me ask you this, Aaron.
We need to go back to that where we don't expect winners right away.
Aaron, we're not going to wait. We're just not going to. I'm not going to. I refuse to.
I know. Patience is a virtue.
Don't they count the ballots as they come in?
It's one of those things where people develop these systems over time about counting ballots. And I think that, there are certain rules against actually count, you can't open the, I don't think in any state anyone actually opens the ballots and counts the votes before election day. I think it's pretty uncommon and really, but it's really more an administrative task of just being able to,
physically open up all those ballots.
Or scan them or whatever procedures you have, because the most important thing that anyone working in election offices is to get the numbers right. That is the most important thing. And so that needs to be the imperative of way beyond, it's far more important than speed of reporting is getting the numbers right.
I think speed more important than getting the numbers right. I just want to know it. Let's find out. I'm joking, of course, Aaron. I'm a little cranky. Let's talk about this report that you guys did about Wisconsin. Wisconsin had two different primaries, or elections, I guess I should say, that were that which is in and of itself just insane. I guess we have a thing called best practices. That to me seems like worst practices. Forget COVID. Just the idea that you would have we're going to do an election a month apart because. Talk about why that's the case, and then what that provided a sort of natural experiment too, didn't it? Or at least some, research project.
Yeah. So Wisconsin, as many of you know, was really ground zero for the right wing's experiment in just totally dismantling public institutions. There was a backlash against that. People in the state consistently have decided, no, that's not what they want. In 2018, Democrats got a majority of the vote for basically everything they ran for. But because the state legislature is so gerrymandered and because the Supreme Court says that's totally fine, Republicans still hold a very large majority in the state legislature. And so when the governor, Tony Evers, said, hey, we're in the midst of a pandemic, let's try to move these elections out until people get a little, more health, until the pandemic subsides a little bit, maybe consolidate them. The Republican legislature, which thrives on making sure that people can't vote, said, no, we will not move this Supreme Court election scheduled in April, or we won't move it to a mail-in balloting. We're going to force people to vote in person in the middle of a pandemic. They held this state Supreme Court election. It was 2 months. I know it seems like 2 years ago, but it was only 2 months ago that they held this really prominent state Supreme Court election in the midst of the pandemic, and it was supposed to be close. I think heading into election day, people thought the conservative candidate was favored because, again, the state Republican Party refused to move the Republicans in the House refused to move the election date, and people had to vote in person. Democrats take COVID more seriously, according to polls. And so people were really worried that the liberal candidate would lose. But then the election results come in, and she won by 10 points. And we were trying to figure out, well, what happened here? And we saw that there was some backlash to people being forced to vote in person, that they were really angry at the Republicans in the legislature for doing that. And so what we did was that we looked at the counties that had the high, we looked at counties' COVID infection rates, and we looked at the rate at which they shifted from past Supreme Court elections to the current one. And we found that a county with a higher COVID infection rate had a greater shift toward the liberal candidate than counties with lower COVID infection rates. And so that's kind of a wonky way of saying is, the harder hit you were by the pandemic, being forced to vote in person incentivized you more to vote for the liberal candidate. And so more broadly, what we think that means is that if Republicans or, Democrats engage in kind of brazen disenfranchisement using the pandemic or maybe the protests against police brutality, if they use that as kind of a pretext to disenfranchise people, it'll just create a backlash against them. People really hate the idea of their rights being taken, and they will brave those conditions to vote against you if they feel like you're doing that.
That's fascinating. So it's the impingement of or infringement of people's rights that motivates them even more than the candidates themselves. And how does that correlate in Wisconsin? Like, did you have like a racial breakdown to that?
In Wisconsin, it's a mostly white state, so there it's kind of hard to do a racial breakdown. I mean, we did see
Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee, I mean, it's kind of tough to do a comparison there, just because it got the worst of the disenfranchisement, but
right.
Also
you
don't have all the data, right. By race, but I mean, because it is a mostly white state, and so I mean, this is mostly among white voters that you're seeing this movement.
That's interesting. I mean, having never had any type of lineage or history of having to fight for the right to vote, essentially, for white people, it seems a little bit counterintuitive to me that they would be that sensitive about someone trying to infringe upon their right to do it. But I guess it's just sort of like also lays bare, how nakedly, interested in voter suppression the Republicans are. I guess that pisses people off. So it'll be interesting to see if that, because there's going to be, right? I mean, we're going to have either, and it also means to me, as far as I can tell, because that was highly publicized, right? Because you had the legislature do this. I mean, there was a very clear clash between Evers and the Republican legislature, backed up by the Republican Supreme Court. I know, conservative Supreme Court in Wisconsin, state court, and then the Republican one in Washington, D.C. They were all involved in basically limiting people's ability to vote in the context of COVID-19. And it was widely publicized, and it was because there was a fight. And so what it also suggests to me is that Democrats need to make a big fight about this. Otherwise, people won't be activated in the way that you're talking about.
No, it's part of it. I mean, you need a message beyond they're trying to take the vote away from you, obviously. But if there is these efforts of disenfranchisement, letting people know that they are they are being conspired against to be disenfranchised, so that, minority rule can be enshrined in the country, that is something that will galvanize people. And I think what we saw, and it's a segue into the next election, which was there was a special congressional election A month later, in kind of the northern half of the state, it was far lower profile. Because it was further into the pandemic, they had kind of done a better job of like getting mail-in balloting working and figuring out how to have safe in-person voting in a way that just didn't exist in the April election. And so what we saw in that election was the opposite happened, was that in counties that had a higher COVID infection rate, the Democrat actually had the least improvement over prior elections, and that really it was, and so to us what that says is you can't just rely on people being mad about COVID to go out to the polls. In fact, because we think polls show that Democrats tend to take the pandemic more seriously than Republicans, it'll be harder to get them out in pandemic conditions unless there is some imperative. I think in the November election, because we saw that in other special elections that have occurred during the pandemic that were like lower profile elections that didn't get as much news attention, Democrats really underperformed. Now, the November election, I certainly hope that that won't be an issue. I think Trump will be unable to soft pedal anything. But it is something to be mindful of, especially when Democrats are working within areas where maybe there haven't been blatant efforts to disenfranchise or reaching out to people who might not be totally excited about the ticket. It really shows you that the pandemic can be a headwind to getting voters out if there isn't something really galvanizing them to go out to the polls.
Good message. I hope somebody's listening, Aaron. Aaron Kleinman, Director of Research at Future Now. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. Stay safe. Bye. Aaron Kleinman, ladies and gentlemen. Let's bring Michael on, and we'll head into the fun half. Is Michael in the queue, as it were?
Yes, he is between the queue and us. So he's in some
netherworld.
Intervening
stage. I'll take that time to say, folks, it is your support that makes the show possible. If you have the means, become a member, by all means, please do. We need your support now as much, if not more, than ever. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com and become a member. Get the extra content and get the fun half commercial free. Also, we've got some technological upgrades for members that are going to be rolling out soon. You'll enjoy those. Don't forget, you're also AM Quickie at amquickie.com. You can sign up there. Just coffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And get the merch. We may have to do another order of stuff. It's crazy. People are really eating up those masks. We're going to be sending thousands of dollars. And we may even get into like five-digit. Well, I think we're going to be, I think between us and the manufacturer of these masks, we're going to be doing like 5-digit to the Pacific Northwest Immigration Defense. What is it? Immigration Defense. I can't remember the name, but it's a immigration rights organization in the Pacific Northwest. So they're doing good. And check out the other merch we got there. Meanwhile, Michael.
Hello, Sam. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Sweet.
Last night, TMBS.
TMBS. We spoke with Chuka Ajekum, who's a labor organizer, and we talked and policy researcher about the relationship between these uprisings and the labor movement and Palestine. I mean, we drew a lot of connections, and Matt Christman and I talked about the experience of being at these protests and wove them in with a conversation about dialectics. And then Artesia Balthrop joined us in the post game and talked about Trump trying to declare martial law in some sense, police rampaging across the country, and why how brands are attempting to participate in this. So we hit a lot. I will say patreon.com/TMBS, and we are taking suggestions because we're going to give a little bit of the haul that we're going to get this month to sort of, you know, bail funds or, you know, a couple of different places. And we know that like some of these places are oversaturated, actually. So we're looking for recommendations for places that are a little bit that are in need of help. So
yeah, bail funds are looking for help.
Yeah, bail funds that are looking for help in cities, I think, that are not Minneapolis or New York.
Right.
Yeah, mutual aid networks, too.
Mutual aid networks, too. Hunger, mass delivery. We'll probably do a little small contribution and split it between three or four groups. So we're actually interested in hearing ones that are maybe less high profile.
Also, along those lines, if you're going out to the protests, you can check out the DART Center, D-A-R-T Center.org. For tips on how to stay safe while you're covering it, if you're covering it as a, you know, sort of, I don't know, official or an unofficial journalist, but also a good tips on how to keep safe, just broadly speaking. So check that out at dartcenter.org. We'll put that link in the podcast description. Also, check out the Noma Key Show. You can find it at patreon.com/TheNomaKeyShow and also Nomiki Const on YouTube at youtube.com. And don't forget the Antifada. Jamie's been out there. Have you guys run into Jamie at the protests?
No.
There's so many anybody. Protests.
Yeah, I haven't run into anybody I know, which is actually a very nice feeling. I would love to see folks, but there's a lot of people out.
It's not the scene anymore.
Yeah. It's not like, oh yeah, we were there at this other thing. it's less like a Fish or Dead Show or something.
Right. Yeah. Not just Patreon or, you know, Bell House shows.
Yeah, exactly.
Like 2 months ago. Like,
yeah, I'll see you at the live podcast in a couple of weeks. Awesome. All right.
Right. Check out the Antifada. You can find it on patreon.com/TheAntifada. What's happening on your Twitch stream, Matt?
Coming soon to Twitch, David Griscom and I, and maybe some of Dave from Jamaica, for instance, we'll be playing Sea of Thieves, the video game. It's sort of like a pirate video game. So that's going to come probably in the next week or so. We're going to practice our pirate skills, and then we'll be taken to the high seas.
So what do you do on that pirate game?
All sorts of things. You can adjust. You have to do everything kind of very deliberately. So you got to fire the cannons. But in order to fire the cannons, you got to go get a cannonball, take it to the cannon.
So wait, is this a first-person like shooter-style game?
The first-person shooter-style game, but you're pirates on pirate ships. And if you get an Xbox, you can join.
Cannonball? Honestly.
And you have to trim the masts. You have to and steer the ships. You could climb up to the what do you call it? I'm blanking on
not the widow's peak, the
crow's nest.
The crow's nest. Right.
Yeah. Right. It's a very
logistical video game.
It's all very fun.
But banal logistics.
Yes.
You gotta make sure you shut the cupboard before you go out onto the deck.
You have to bail water if you take down.
How much flowers on this ship?
Exactly.
Someone take an inventory.
It's a bit more cartoon than that, but yeah, twitch.tv/literaryhangover.
So now all the oranges fell out on the floor, and now everybody's going to get scurvy.
Right, hey, I love that stuff.
It actually sounds kind of interesting. Yeah.
The scurvy thing, actually, I'm onto something, I feel like. All right. I had an idea for a game at one point, which was just like, you start in the jungle. It was all based on I think it was
Apocalypse Now.
No, Nicaragua or something. I can't remember. Where you start in the jungle and you go into a village, and every decision you make in that village and all the villages it takes you to get to Managua or something, lead up to your ability to go forward in terms of your strength and building your numbers, but also, you know, because sometimes you got to take people's food, so you lose their popular support. When it comes to taking over the and doing a popular coup.
That's a cool game.
I mean, there are games that exist like that, but
that's definitely a cool
game. There are games that have those types of dynamics, but they don't ever set it in real history, which is cowardice on the part of video
games. Total cowardice.
Yeah, that's total cowardice.
All right. Hey, folks, before we go, an Embark Breed and Health Test Kit is the key to unlocking your dog's unique breed mix. and genetically informed health needs. It can identify over 350 breeds, types, and varieties, and screen for over 175 genetic health conditions, which helps you provide the best medical care for your dog. Go to EmbarkVet.com now. Use the promo code MAJORITY. You get $50 off your dog and breed health kit. That's EmbarkVet.com with code MAJORITY for $50 off your dog and breed health kit. As always, we'll put the links in our podcast and YouTube descriptions. Check it out. We're going to take a quick break. We'll head into the fun half. You can join us by becoming a member at JoinTheMajorityReport.com. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's a good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.